This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Hello, welcome to Contemplations. I'm Josh and I'm joined by Hugo, and we're going to talk about what the best punishment might be.
Yep, and we're going to continue our yesterday's discussion because yesterday we talked about different theories of punishment. So we were talking about how to justify punishment, right? And so we saw that different theories justify punishment differently. Some say that you need to punish people to get them not to do that anymore and to get other people not to do bad things anymore. And some other theories might say that you need to punish them because they deserve it. They did something wrong. They deserve something wrong happening to them. And so today we're just going to be focusing on different methods that people can be punished and which are better and which are worse, because that's an important factor in it as well. And the discussion kind of flows into it because some of the theories imply that some of the methods of punishing people are better and some of them are worse. And so we're going to go into that. And so we're going to be focusing on criminal justice and not kind of civil stuff, not something that's just solved by, that's just about like contracts and enforcement of contracts. Like if one side doesn't do what they're supposed to do, then they need to kind of make it up. We're not going to be talking about that. We're going to be focusing on criminal justice because it's something that's usually seen as more serious and usually is more serious, something that you did seriously wrong, not just kind of petty squabbles, right? And so first I wanted to point out something that is specific to criminal justice that you hinted at yesterday, but that is, I think, very important and quite central to what we're talking about, is that criminal justice is based on that weird concept that there's two sides of law, right? Public law and private law. And what private law is that governs relationship between individuals, right? And that's mediated often by the state, often not, but it's whatever, contract law, right? And then you have the sphere of public law, which governs your relationship between you and the state. And so criminal law is part of that public law, which is something that I find really weird because it's based on the concept that you hurt society and not individuals. And what really is society? Like you can't, it's hard to define, and it's hard to say that there is some entity that is harmed by you harming a specific person, right? If that entity has almost nothing to do with it. But this is basically this view of having criminal law under that public law, just under that umbrella which governs the relationship between you and the state. It just says that your victim is not the real victim. The real victim is actually society, and the actual victim is just go on the side somewhere.
You know? Is it not just based on a practical implication that more often than not, it's the state that is the neutral arbiter in a dispute between two citizens?
But that's not how it is. That's the point. because one in a criminal case, the two sides aren't the victim and the perpetrator. It's the state and the perpetrator, or the alleged perpetrator.
That
the victim is
sound...
on the side because you've got the state prosecutor that is the one side of that conflict. And that's why this is so weird, right? Because it's not a case between those two people, between the victim and the perpetrator. It's the case between the prosecutor and the perpetrator.
I mean, I don't know very much about this. I've
so this view says that, as I said, your victim is not the real victim, that the real victim is actually society. And then because states in the current environment kind of pretend to be the chief representatives of society, then the victim is actually the state, right?
Is that explicit or is that just implied in how it's structured?
It is to a certain extent explicit. It's like, it doesn't call itself the victim, right? But it says that it is that one side of that conflict, right? So you don't have that conflict happening anymore between the perpetrator and the victim. That's explicit and that's kind of open.
Okay.
And so if you break a contract, then a counterparty is the victim that you had the contract with. But if you break someone's leg, the state is the victim for some reason.
The state has a victim complex, apparently.
Well, that's what we talked about last week. Go watch the contemplations from last week because we discussed that. And so, just as an aside, you can get compensation for bodily injury. Like if you break someone's leg, they can get compensation from you. But that doesn't happen in that criminal case. That happens in a civil case that you can launch separately from that, but you don't have to. Like that doesn't happen automatically just by them being prosecuted. That's separate, at least in Western countries.
Okay.
So that is really weird that this is how it's set up. And it kind of illustrates that in different approaches to punishing people, you kind of value different things. So here the real victim is secondary and what is primary is what society, quote unquote, does with the offender. It's obviously you can tell that this is not how I see it. Mm-hmm. How I see it would be more like the transactional approach to crime or to criminality. Like that's how I would see it. And as we go along today, I think I'm going to explain a bit more of what that's about. But but to just reiterate what that situation is like, I'm just going to quote from Rothbard again from The Ethics of Liberty. Quote, "What happens nowadays is the following absurdity. A steals $15,000 from B. The government tracks down, tries, and convicts A, all at the expense of B, as one of the numerous taxpayers victimized in this process. Then the government, instead of forcing A to repay B or to work at forced labor until the debt is paid, forces B, the victim, to pay taxes to support the criminal in prison for 10 or 20 years' time. Where in the world is the justice here? The victim not only loses his money, but pays more money besides for the dubious thrill of catching, convicting, and then supporting the criminal. And the criminal is still enslaved, but not to the good purpose of recompensating the victim." And so that's this kind of absurd scenario, or not scenario. That's the situation that we're in. Like this is how criminal justice works right now, right? So you have one party that is the victim that just gets mostly ignored, and then you just have the beef between the state and the perpetrator, and then the victim, along with a lot of other people that are not involved in it, and pay for housing for that perpetrator to be kept somewhere. And so the victim is not provided any compensation if they don't launch a separate kind of process. But instead, they have to pay a part of their money to give to the perpetrator, right?
I understand the point that Rothbard's trying to make there, but I would have thought that there would be some monetary recompense for that, especially in the case of theft. Surely there'd be some return of money to the victim, right? That can't be the case. Like, I'm no expert in law or punishment or anything, so I am asking from a point of genuine ignorance here.
So I think damages like that or compensation can be awarded, but it's usually not. It's just whether that guy goes to prison or not, and then you have that separate process that in a civil court, not in criminal court, that can result and will result then in damages being paid.
But the point being made by Rothbard there is that is a form of punishment in and of itself for the victim in having to pay for the imprisonment of the criminal.
Yes, exactly. Like that's one of the points that he was making, and maybe the most important. Yeah, that's what you intuitively touched upon yesterday as well, because that's kind of the glaring thing that's really weird about it.
Yeah.
And so I think that when we're rating different methods of punishment, we kind of move past this in a problem. I just wanted to lay out this in the beginning, because this is really absurd, in my opinion, an absurd way of how criminal law operates at the moment. And so we've got two axes on which we can rate different methods of punishing people. And I think those might be good criteria to kind of to rank them or to rate them, because it doesn't make it too difficult, and we can do it quite quickly and quite nicely, and I think it's going to be a good discussion. So those two axes are going to be morality and utility. And morality, it just means, is it just to do that thing that you're going to do to the perpetrator? Is it a good thing to do? Is it ethical? And utility just means, is it practical to do it? And then I divide that utility and criterion into two separate sub-criteria, which are whether it's the criterion of convenience, whether it's convenient, and of the risks, what are the risks tied to it. And so so we can get on with the actual rating of the punishment methods.
Sure.
So let's take the one that is most widely used today, which is imprisonment. So is it moral? I would say that incarceration itself, that depends, right? Because you've got that axis of what prisons can look like. On the one hand, you can have something like Alcatraz, and on the other, you can have like almost hotels that are quite nice and enjoyable, right?
Yeah, I've seen some of the Scandinavian prisons, and they look really nice. I mean, I wouldn't mind living there. Like, they even have their own island and go for walks and stuff like that. I'm just like, wow, being in prison there, that's great.
Exactly. And so then when you're talking about proportionality, then you need to, like, you obviously need to ask what did they do, and then you need to look at what the circumstances of their incarceration are, whether it's something that looks about right or not. Like, fine, you know, it might be moral, might be something that you want or not, I don't know. Like, it really depends on what it's like.
I think sorry to cut you off there.
Of course, there is this kind of shared aspect of restricting your movement, restricting your liberty, but it's also like different. You can be in a small cell where you can't move very much, or you can have a tennis court, you know. Like,
I think imprisonment makes the most sense when the person is too dangerous to have in amongst wider society. If they are violent in particular, I think it makes sense to remove them from wider society, because it prevents the risk of them reoffending. And you get the case of perhaps someone who is like a serial killer. You don't really want them out and about.
Yep.
And it makes sense to keep them separate from wider society, because there's the understanding, at least in the psychological sphere, that these people can't really be rehabilitated, and you can't ever get them back to being a normal functional member of society once they've kind of crossed into that territory.
I've actually got that written down as one of the advantages, kind of the moral, on the moral side of it, just that this is moral good to prevent them from being predatory again by just isolating them. But also you've got different methods of punishment which satisfy the same thing, which provide the same kind of service. And so that's not exclusive to imprisonment. But then that financing thing that we talked about a minute ago, that factors into the morality of the whole thing, because under the current system, the victim, along with other people who have nothing to do with it, pay for the incarceration, which is just ludicrous, right?
Could you not have a system where the criminal also has to pay for like their board, like it's almost like a hotel.
Exactly, and we're gonna get to that under the heading forced labor. So
that sounds really ominous. Okay.
And so, is imprisonment practical? Right, convenience. It's quite convenient, easy to manage. It's expensive. Quite expensive, very expensive mm-hmm. in some cases, but it's easy to manage, right? In one building, in some guards, some barbed wire, that's it. Yeah, and you have to keep them inside. It's not like logistically like difficult, right? It's something that is quite easy to do from that point of view.
I would say mm-hmm. that a prison complex is quite elaborate though, and I imagine that they cost quite a lot.
Yep.
In that you've got to have everything in these walls yep. that a human being would need, which is quite yep. a lot, really.
Yep. No, I'm not saying it's easy to run that facility. It's sure. it's easy to manage that kind of system, right?
Yeah.
And so the risk associated with it, like, because that's the other half of whether it's practical or not. Someone can be wrongfully imprisoned, and then they can get compensation for it. So those risks are kind of mitigated by that. But then one risk that is real, I think, is that it's easy to start incarcerating for minor stuff just because it's convenient. It you can produce an injustice just by starting to say, okay, I'm gonna lock up everyone who did something really minor, something not too wrong.
Jaywalking.
Something like that, yeah. And so that is one risk. So that's kind of the overall picture that I have of incarceration. So let's move on to ostracism. I've got it actually written under ostracism/exile because mm-hmm. those are the two different extents to which you can practice the same thing, I think. And so is it moral? Private ostracism, I would say that is perfectly moral. You can choose with whom you associate, with whom you don't. Like that's fine. There's no problems from my point of view. And this kind of private ostracism can grow into something social or society-wide mm-hmm. if there's enough people or enough actors participating in it. So that it can be significant. It can be a significant burden or cost on that person who is being ostracized, not just something that your family doesn't like you, right? Sure. So then is exile moral then? Well, based on the severity, right? So just you can't say that it's moral or it's not. Like, it depends for what. So it used to be in history used as the second worst punishment after the death penalty.
I know that they tried to exile Socrates and yep. he actually said, oh, well, I'd rather be killed. And that's yeah. why he drank hemlock rather than go into exile.
I mean, he was a bit of an extremist in that. Yeah. But at the same time, it was in a lot of situations, in a lot of societies, in the past, it used to be really bad to it wasn't easy to survive without kind of other people around you constantly, and like it was very easy for you to kind of die or like mm-hmm. yeah not be in a very good condition if you're outside, if no one can actually be involved with you or help you in any way,
right? It seems like a death sentence with just mm-hmm. the state being like rubbing its hands with it. It's just like, well, we didn't actually kill them, but they're going to yeah. go out into the wilderness and die anyway.
Yeah, so I mean, that's something that wouldn't be the same today just because of how widespread mm-hmm. humanity is over the globe and like where society is and where it isn't, right? So but one good thing about exile, again, just as with incarceration, is that you can prevent further violations because that person is somewhere else, so they can't do anything to you, so good. Ostracism, probably not. If you're getting ostracized and that places a burden on you, you might start to be spiteful instead, so that might be something that might actually make it worse rather than make it better. So okay, might not be that good in that. So in this moral way, when we're considering the victims, it might be a bit counterproductive if you execute it in some specific mm-hmm. ways. So is it practical? Well, convenience wise, I would say that in today's kind of this system that we have of states and citizenship and you belonging to a certain state and then that state having some kind of responsibility for you, but in some ways they do, in some ways don't really, but some obligations they do. And so exiling someone would be a major headache, like internationally, right? Because you can only exile someone to the territory of another state that's adjacent to you, which is
it doesn't seem very realistic, right? Yeah, like the logistics of it would be annoying.
Exactly.
I think that's part of the reason why in kind of the British Empire would send people over to Australia.
Exactly.
It's just like send them to the opposite side of the world.
I come to think of that, what I was thinking about is that like how you could solve this or whatever, like mitigate this. You could pay another state to host the offender, right? So just like you don't want them here, but there is a cost associated with them, so you pay another state to take them. The other state can kind of might just accept it because they need money or something, and they don't care about kind of
having murderers just hanging around.
Like, could happen. I'm not saying it's good. I'm saying that is one way that you could solve that convenience problem, right?
Wouldn't that just send all of the kind of murderers and all of the bad people to the poorest countries who are going to be like, well, we'll take the money, and I suppose we're going to have to just put up with the murderer walking around.
I mean, I don't think this would be widespread or anything, because it would probably be bad in terms of kind of PR, right? So I would say that this would be very rare, but I was just brainstorming ways to solve this kind of convenience problem. Like, what could you do about it? Like, if you want to exile someone, but you can't just send them to the state next over, because that's not an option.
Look at Edward Snowden. He's been exiled to Russia, more or less, by the United States.
And so I think that in this case, you could have a lot of people from third world countries actually coming to like first world countries, because if you want to punish someone, but you don't want to create like a PR disaster locally or for your own kind of society because they're controversial or something, you can pay kind of a rich estate to take them, to take that person, because from that, I don't know, maybe from a Western point of view, they might have not committed any crimes, but they've committed some crime that is a crime in some kind of backwater country, right?
I'm thinking of like homosexuality in Africa, where they're all very Christian, and they don't like that sort of thing, whereas it's acceptable.
Yeah. So if you want to avoid controversy, you could just send them abroad, pay some country that doesn't consider what they did to be a crime. You just get rid of them that way, right? If you want to exile them,
mm-hmm.
one option, right? And so, right. So if you deal with that kind of diplomatic stuff, I would say that the other administrative stuff is easy about it, because you don't need to do anything. You just need to prevent them from re-entering, right? Just, you don't have to worry about anything. Unlike running the prisons, that's like one bar, but this bar is even lower. Right? So good. And is it? What are the risks? You can get wrongfully exiled. You can get compensation later for being wrongfully exiled. That's fine. You know, just no problems with that. Or like, obviously, like problems, but it's acceptable. And then the problem is that it's quite hard to reverse private ostracism. It can be almost permanent, right? So if you get someone to ostracize someone else, then changing their mind might be very difficult down the line. And then another one is that it's easy to turn that into a kind of witch hunt, ostracism specifically. So you risk not following the correct procedure, not making sure that they're actually guilty. And so making that a big problem of being society that is just hypersensitive to that and causing problems for everyone. And so those are the kind of that's the snapshot that I've kind of created of that range of punishments that you could have.
Mm-hmm.
Then next is forced labor, which is sounds bad, but let me just give the snapshot again.
Okay.
So the major moral advantage of forced labor is that it can provide restitution to the victim, right? Can provide it better than the others, because they can work their way out of their debts to the victim. If you put someone in prison, that's not happening. The victim doesn't get anything. If they get something, they probably get that from someone else, from the state or something like that, because the perpetrator might not have any ways to actually pay it. And so forced labor deals with that, right? So that's a major advantage morally if you're considering the morality for the victim.
All I've got in my head is just gulags. So it's very difficult to think of it as anything other than completely awful.
Fair enough. That's my other point, is that it has bad historical connotation, understandably. But
I can't see why. Oh.
But then if you think about it kind of from a bit distance point of view, any of those methods that we talked about and that mm-hmm. we're going to talk about are really bad and are awful if you apply them in when you shouldn't, mm-hmm. right? And so if you lock up someone, that's really bad, you know, that you're locking them up, especially if it's something wrong, especially if it's something like Alcatraz. You're doing something awful and when you shouldn't. So this is not specific to this method of forced labor. This is common to all of those methods. It's just that we're really sensitive to that because of historical stuff.
Yeah, and I think that there are some advantages in a kind of more enlightened labor-focused punishment, in that you could get prisoners to pick up skills.
Yep.
And I know that this is particularly popular in America, but it also has its limitations in that through having the forced labor in the United States, it keeps prices at such a low level that private enterprises can't compete, because it is essentially slave labor, right? But then on the other hand, if you've got criminals who are resorting to crime out of necessity and then saying, okay, we're going to teach you how to make chairs and teach you how to be a carpenter, then they're going to have some kind of profession in which they, upon leaving mm-hmm. this punishment, can then fall back on rather than resorting to yep. crime. So in some circumstances it might make sense, but then in others it seems like it's counterproductive, particularly yep. for private enterprise, and particularly when the forced labor is extreme, like it was in the USSR, where
just as you can have very different circumstances of imprisonment, you can have very different circumstances of forced labor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, school is to some extent forced labor, so and then so the practical stuff about forced labor, convenience might be more difficult to administer and oversee. That's something that is to the detriment of that. That is it is much more difficult than ostracism or exile, and it's still more difficult than imprisonment. It's mm-hmm. something that you need a lot of. It might produce a lot of headaches to kind of administer that. But then what are the risks? The risks is that I don't think there's actually that many risks if you look at it compared with the other methods, because if you're wrongfully forced to work, you can get compensation, right? That's the common thread to in all of those that we discussed so far. So, and I can't really think of the risks in the sense of the word that we talked about it so far mm-hmm. that would be associated with it. But if you can, I mean, feel free to bring them up.
If there are dangerous criminals and they're in an environment where they're making stuff, like in a factory or in like carpentry or something practical of that nature, having them around lots of machinery and tools might give them opportunities to kill one another.
Right.
That could be a risk.
Sure.
Yeah. If you've got a big saw and then you've got loads of violent criminals, I can imagine they can think of lots of creative uses for that.
So let's now move on to another, which is simply violence. So you can do something bad to that person, to an actual body of that person, right? So is that moral? Under some theories of punishment, sure, because you might deserve it, right? For example, under mm-hmm. the retributive theory, if you've broken someone's arm intentionally, well, you deserve to have your arm broken because that's what you did. That's what should be done to you. And so that depends on how it's done, I think, whether it's moral or not, because it might be arbitrary. It might be inflicted by a third party, such as the state, who might not have any specific interest in doing this or that. And so they might do something completely arbitrary. And then that's probably not something that is going to be very moral, because it's going to be maybe disproportionate or something that is not related to the crime that's actually been mm-hmm. committed. And then on the other hand, it might give the victim more options. For example, you could have it as a bonus to restitution, right? So if we talked about the double restitution thing yesterday, mm-hmm. and so if the perpetrator has to pay you something, and then they also need to be punished because one half is restitution, one half is retribution, and so you could actually get a restitution bonus if they buy themselves out of that punishment, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you might get more out of it as the victim, and you have more choices as the victim. You have more options, which is good, which is a moral thing to do, to give the victim more options if they've been wronged. And so that's kind of the summary. And then, is it practical? Well, it's very fast and cheap. It's convenient, so it's fine. that's the pros.
I can imagine the death penalty has a 0% reoffending rate. I mean,
yeah, I've actually got execution under a separate heading, but you're completely
that's
right about that.
Surely violence, though, right?
Yeah, yeah, I know, but it's the most extreme kind of version. Well,
I also don't agree with it. Just to throw that out there.
So, violence. Are there any risks? Well, if we're talking about some permanent damage to a person's body that cannot be undone, well, you kind of can give a compensation for that, but it might be massive, and it's not really that just. You know, you can't repair that, so it's not in contrast with all the methods previously discussed. This one has problems here, right?
I think it's got lots of problems elsewhere as well. Like, it's clearly not ethical to just harm someone based on, especially if it's like state enforced as well. It just seems really immoral, like the most immoral choice out of any punishment.
Yeah, but I mean, if it depends on which theory you subscribe to. If you're really hardline retributist, I guess, you think that that the perpetrator deserves it, and so it doesn't mean that it has to happen to them, but it can, you know. So it's something that would be just. Yeah.
So if they're caught stealing, they get their hands cut off, that sort of thing.
No. What? No. So it's not proportionate at all.
I'm just giving a historic example. I don't actually agree with it.
You're just making it look bad.
Well, being violent in response to something isn't—it's like an eye for an eye.
Yeah, but like cutting your hands off because you stole something is not an eye for an eye.
I know that's a bad example, but a very extreme example as well.
If you cut someone's hands off, then we can talk about cutting someone's hands off.
Sorry, do you carry on?
No, it's okay. I just didn't want you to bad mouth violence.
I'm more than happy to badmouth that.
No, now I'm just saying things to solicit responses. Okay, let's get on to the last one, which is execution, which I already mentioned a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So, is it moral? Well, depends on the crime and the theory, right? If you can say that you deserve it, like if you kill someone, if you cause someone to die for some reason, whatever, or if you do something equally as wrong in some way, then you might say that person deserves it, right? And so if they deserve it, then this would be warranted. This would be a moral thing to do. The drawback is that doesn't help the victim at all. I mean, that victim might be glad that the person is taken away or something, that they can't harm them anymore. Sure. Like the victim, I mean, the
mm-hmm.
if you kill someone, for example, then the family, or like there's no restitution, right? It's just retribution, and so it's really on the extreme end of that kind of approach. And so, is it practical? Yes, it's fast and cheap, convenient.
Well, in the United States, they keep them held for like 10 years before they're executed. Yeah, I don't really understand that.
But that's you've got different details in application. But this thing itself, you know, like you can have you would say that that's a combination of incarceration and then execution, right? So you have to separate that. But itself, like execution, is fast and cheap, convenient. That's like that practicality criterion is like check. You know, it's just like it's sad, but that's what it is. And so the risks. Basically, like there's an obvious risk that it's irreversible, so that there can be no compensation for wrongful execution. So like that is a very real drawback of it.
So that is
actually why I included that kind of remark for each of the previous ones, because here it's on the opposite end where you can't give anyone compensation for having done something wrong, for punishing them wrongfully, right?
Of course, yeah.
And so that is kind of the summary of that. And so those were the, I think, five or six that I wanted to go through. And to finish it off, I wanted to mention an estoppel approach to punishment, which is something that I've just read about. It's proposed by Stefan Kinsella in 2004. And it's about the victim choosing their own method of punishment as long as proportionality is satisfied. And so I'm going to quote from what he says to just illustrate the point. Quote, "The victim of assault and battery need not be restricted to only having the aggressor beaten or even killed. The victim may abhor violence and might choose to forego any punishment at all if his only option was to either beat or punish the aggressor. The victim may prefer instead to simply be compensated monetarily out of any current or future property of the wrongdoer. If the victim will gain more satisfaction from using force against the aggressor in a way different than the manner in which the aggressor violated the victim's rights, the aggressor is clearly stopped from complaining about this as long as proportionality is satisfied." And so, stopped means, well, it's estoppel, that's what this is all about. That means that the perpetrator cannot complain about the victim doing something because the perpetrator did something previously, so their complaints are dismissed. Like, they're not allowed to complain about something. Like, that's a legal concept that is used in a specific way here. And so he says further, quote, "No punishment can undo the harm done." If it's something like, it can apply quite widely. I think that is not just a narrow concept. So, quote, "No punishment can undo the harm done. For this reason, the victim should not be artificially or easily restricted in his range of punishment options, because this would be to further victimize him. The victim did not choose to be made a victim, did not choose to be placed in a situation where he has only one narrow punishment option, namely eye for an eye retaliation. On the contrary, the responsibility for this situation is entirely that of the aggressor, who, by his action, has damaged the victim. Because the aggressor has placed the victim in a no-win situation where being restricted to one narrow type of remedy may recompense the victim even less than other remedies, the aggressor is stopped from complaining if the victim chooses among varying types of punishment subject to the proportionality requirement," unquote. And so that's kind of an interesting view that I came across, saying, okay, you need proportionality as the basis of it. But then if you satisfy proportionality, if you establish some proportionality that is appropriate, then you can, the victim should be able to choose the method of punishment for the perpetrator.
In this case that the state would arbitrate like almost like a menu of punishments, just where the victim can kind of pick off that.
Yes.
Okay, actually I fancy some money, so I'll pick that. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Well, that all makes sense.
I mean, that sounds a bit weird considering what we have here now, but it's something that gives the victim more options. Which is something that you want, because the victim is the victim and they should get some restitution.
That certainly seems reasonable, as long as it's not them choosing the options and the state is the one handing them the choice, then that seems like it's at least not going to be subject to some of the other problems that we discussed in yesterday's episode.
And so to conclude, this episode was just to kind of broaden the horizons of people who might be listening to this and watching this, because I think that today's system and the thinking about this is quite limited. People are not usually considering different methods of punishment and different advantages and drawbacks that they might have, right? Maybe there is a death penalty discussion, but that is in itself quite narrow. And so in some ways, the system today, as we illustrated in the example in the beginning, is quite barbaric. It's awful in how victims are treated, because they're left out of the discussion. And so bringing them back in might be a good thing. I think that's a quite easy argument to make. And so hopefully we can kind of raise some awareness with this. Maybe down the line, some change can come out of this so that the justice system is more just.
Okay. Thank you very much for watching.
Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.